Good afternoon. So last time we covered taking our pipelining concept and actually applying it to that single cycle processor that you're hopefully building for the homework that's due very soon or have already done. And we talked about how we divide it up into pipeline stages. We learned that the book stages are mostly reasonable pipeline stages with a big caveat that we need to deal with the PC, that we didn't want to wait for five things to happen, five cycles, as it would turn out, in order to update the PC, so we moved the PC update to the fetch stage. And as we'll discuss today, that caused a bit of problems that we'll have to fix. But for most instructions, that was easy to do. We just compute the instruction length, figure out where the address of the next instruction is based on that, just like we did for our single cycle processor. The same logic, we just do it in a different stage to make our pipeline always be full, to always have an instruction to fetch in the next cycle. We talked about writing pipeline stages. We had this idea that the stage was kind of self-contained. We had the box that contained the stage. It got some inputs from the previous stage, which always come from registers, because while that stage is working, we're using those inputs. And we had some outputs, which went to the next stage, which always went to registers. And a lot of our stages work was just moving values from our input to our output with some changes. And of course, stages contained some components that they needed to manipulate. For example, our memory stage was responsible for doing whatever the data memory needed to do. We need to read a data value, write a data value that was done in the memory stage, and we manipulate those components based on its inputs and put any results in its outputs. And if we ever needed a value from a prior stage, we'd pass it through registers, which means if we needed a value from several stages back, like from a fetch, we had to pass it from fetch to the decode, decode to execute, and so on, up to the stage where we actually wanted the value. Talked about probably the most annoying problem with our pipeline, which is that if we just did the straightforward thing, we got the wrong answer. So it didn't work. And this problem is called a data hazard. Our pipeline would read the wrong value, and this was because reads and writes happened in a different order with our pipeline processor than our single cycle one. So we didn't maintain the illusion that our single cycle processor and our pipeline processor were the same. And we have the same problem with control instructions like conditional jumps, call, return, not call, but return, that the pipeline doesn't know the next instruction to run. So this was a more straightforward problem than our data hazard, where like we implement our pipeline and suddenly we get the wrong answer. At least here we know, I don't know what the pipeline should do in that case at all. Like conditional jump happens, how do I know what to do? The comparison wouldn't even have happened yet. And so that's known as a control hazard. And we learned the simplest, like conceptually simplest, maybe not simplest to implement, but simplest conceptually solution to these hazards is we're going to insert knobs. And it would be really annoying to have like the compiler and assembly writers insert knobs, and that would change the ISA. So we're going to have the hardware do it. The hardware is going to somehow detect that, one of these hazards is happening, and it's going to, instead of fetching a new instruction, and using that instruction and passing it through the pipeline, it's going to pass a knob through the pipeline and delay fetching that new instruction and actually using it until the hazard won't be a problem anymore. So any questions about any of this we covered last time? Okay. So I'm going to review our control hazard. So one of our control hazards was that we have a conditional jump, and we don't know after we fetch this conditional jump, say from address 2, we don't know what to fetch next. And we can't know because in order to know what to fetch next, we have to look at the result of this, the comparison that's going to be done on these values, which is being computed as we're supposed to be fetching the instruction. Like, we just don't know the information soon enough. So our solution is going to be that we're going to stall. that we're going to wait until we would have that value, and then we're going to actually keep going through the pipeline. And the way this is actually going to look, here, the most straightforward thing to do seems to be that we're just going to wait in the fetch stage until we get the answer. We're going to picture that differently when we talk about our processor, which is that we're going to say that we're going to pass the jump through the pipeline, and then we're going to have the fetch stage after the jump just wait to figure out what the next instruction is when we're implementing a stall like this. It turns out we won't do this for jump, but we'll do this for ret, and it's going to be the same idea, that we're going to pass the jump through the pipeline. And the reason to do that is that we're going to have our condition codes be somewhere in our processor. So we're going to draw our boxes for our stages. And the way our textbook draws those boxes, the execute stage is the box that contains the condition codes. So anything we do with the condition codes happens in the execute stage. So if we want the conditional jump instruction to do that, we need to send it all the way to the execute stage. So we're going to get it to the execute stage. And once it goes through the execute stage, we're going to figure that out. And we're going to read ZF in this stage. We're going to process based on what the conditional jump is and actually figure out whether it's taken or not, send that signal back to fetch, which is waiting for that result, and then the fetch stage is going to say which value it's going to use of the two it's been keeping in mind while it's waiting for the jump to finish. So this idea makes sense, that we send the jump down the pipeline, and the jump does work in the execute phase, and that work is figure out if the jump is taken. And the next instructions fetch phase is going to have to wait for that work to be finished. So we also have this same scenario for return. So for return, in our worst case, the return address might have been stored in the previous instruction for this empty function. So we're going to send the return all the way through the pipeline up to the memory stage, just like a memory read instruction. But when we read memory, instead of storing that value in a register by passing it to the write back stage, we're going to pass that value to the fetch stage in the next cycle. And we're going to use that to figure out what to fetch in the next cycle. So you load the return address, and we're going to send that loaded return address as the PC for the next cycle. And while we're doing that, we're going to have to wait for that to finish. We don't have anything to do because we have no idea what instruction to run next. So while that return is going down the pipeline, our fetch stage is just doing nothing and passing nops down the pipeline. Since, yes, we're going to be reading something from the instruction memory, but it's not useful, so we're just going to replace it with a nop, send it down the pipeline, and waste a few cycles. So any questions about this timeline? Okay, so when we're done, here are the pipeline stages we're left with. We have our fetch, which is where we use the instruction memory and do most, but not all, PC computation. So you've seen that we moved our conditional jump and our figuring out return addresses to the stages where we have that information. We do our condition code read and write from the execute stage. So for conditional jumps, that's where we're going to do that. And this is helpful because it ensures that we always get the value from the previous instruction. We don't have to worry about data hazards for the condition codes because we're always reading them in order. We never read it too early. With registers, we have to read the register before we write it, several stages before we write it, so we can't use this trick. And we're going to halt by running the stat register. And because that's how we halt, we don't want to do it until the halt gets to the write back stage. Otherwise, if there's an instruction that writes memory before it or changes a register, it won't happen. Because we'll halt too early, we'll stop the processor. Any questions about timeline? Okay, so now that we've done this, we have some stalling to resolve hazards. So we have three cycles extra for every return, two cycles extra for every conditional jump, and up to three cycles for data dependencies, depending on how far away it is. So this is where we are now. So it's not horrible if our programs mostly don't have data dependencies that are too close so close that they create a hazard of, like, usually when we access a register, we don't access it again for a couple instructions, and we don't have many returns and conditional jumps. We're gonna run at nearly our ideal speed. But this seems pretty bad. And in particular, this up to 3 cycles for data dependency seems pretty bad. That we don't like that very much because, you know, we're often gonna hit the 3-cycle case where we, like, do add using into RBX and then add another thing into RBX. And this is exactly that, almost the worst case for that. So we want to avoid that. So the question is, can we do better? And we're gonna think about how we can improve most of these. So there's one which we're not gonna improve. One where we're not gonna have a solution that we're gonna implement, though real processors do have a solution that we'll talk about probably not today. That's for return. So for return, we don't have a good solution at all, because how would we even figure out where to go without reading memory? And we can't, like, read memory out of order, because what if there's an instruction reading memory when we want to do that? So there's not an easy solution we have so far. Later on, we'll talk about how real processors solve this problem and usually make return faster, but not always. So for our data dependencies, we're gonna have this trick where we're gonna reduce this time by a lot, and that's to use values waiting to get to the register file. So this uses observation that often when we have a data hazard, that it's not that the value isn't computed yet at all, it's just that it's not in the register file yet. So we're going to figure out, oh, I already computed that value, but it's in the wrong place, and I'm gonna just move it to the right place to solve that problem. And we can see that here. So this here, in our simple data hazard case, we're adding 800 and 900, we get 1700, then we're taking that 1700 and adding it to 800. Well, we should have had 1700 here, and it's already exists. It's in the pipeline. It's in the pipeline, it's being used by the write-back stage, but we haven't written it back yet. But we have the value, and that's the value we want, if only we could send it to the right place. So we can see that we have this value here, and then we have our old value that's coming in on this wire, and we have the new value we want here, and we don't want this old value here, we want the new value that we just computed for instruction one, and we want it to replace whatever we just read. So our solution is we're gonna just make a shortcut. We're just gonna take a wire, add a wire to replace that value. We don't always want to do that, so we're gonna have a mux. So sometimes the value I want is this 1700 I just computed, the value from instruction one. Other times we aren't reading what instruction one just wrote, so I want the value from the register file, which is hopefully the right one. And we call this process of making this shortcut forward, that we're forwarding the value that's about to be written to an older instruction, bypassing the register file, because the register file won't have the value in time. And this allows us to avoid some stalling, because you didn't have to wait for that 1700 to make it through the write-back stage to the end of that clock cycle in order to effectively read it by replacing the value that was just read. So any questions on this mux I added here? So how do I set the control signals for the mux? So we'll get to that in a bit. So what information do you think we might want to know used to compute that? So we need what register is involved. So that's one important thing to think about, is that we have register numbers. We're going to need to actually use them, even though I don't have them, like, I don't have the signals listed on this picture. Okay, so here I'm replacing the 1700. I'd note that we could do it the other way around, that instead of replacing R of source A with the value, we could have to forward into R of source B if we read R9 in the second place in the instruction. So we're going to have two cases here, two muxes for both cases. So as for what the conditions are, so the basic idea is that we have to decide, for example, whether we take this path. And that's going to be based on register numbers. So we're going to have register numbers in this pipeline. So we have here, we have, this is going into here is E of dest E. Going into here is W of dest E. Going into here is F of RA, F of RB. This is D of RA, which is equal to reg source A. So we have a bunch of register numbers that are just lying around, and we're going to need to use them somehow to figure out what this mux should do. And this is why we went over the naming convention, because here it matters which is which. This is D of dest D. I should label these correctly. W, so the naming convention, which I forgot when labeling this, is that the output of the decode stage is lowercase d, the input of the execute stage is uppercase d. And here is W of dest d. So all the wires in a particular stage are prefixed with the letter of that stage. Sorry for breaking that one. So given that information, what should our condition be? So we have this is our D of val A. And sometimes we're going to take the actual output of the register file. It's the normal case, if nothing special is happening. And sometimes we're going to substitute in this E val E, the result of the ALU. So what is the condition? So we have some options here. So I will figure it out yourself. So compare with the neighbor. I'll give you a minute or so. And for a signal like big W of RA, assume we just take D of RA and just pass it through the pipeline, like we saw for iCode for like setting the memory control signals last time. Even though I haven't drawn that on this picture. Yes.
Before when you had users add Q, R10, and then R9, we aren't doing that.
Yes. Remember to mention that that case involves setting the other mux in this picture. Okay, who needs more time? No one's volunteering if they do. Okay, so who thinks it's A? B? Okay, C? D? E? Okay, so we have a majority seems to think that it's E. And the way I like thinking about this is that we have a sort of related pair of values, that eval E is going to E dest E. So if I want, so I'm saying that do I want eval E? I'm asking, I should look at E dest E because that's where that's going. So I'm saying, do I want the value that's going to be written to E dest E? And I want it if I just read if this source A, so this reg source A here is another pair, if it's a newer version of whatever reg output A was, and reg output A comes from reg source A, so I want to compare the register number that reg output A is for to the register number that eval E is for. And that's how I make this decision. And I know eval E is something I might want to forward because if it's the value of that register, it's a more recent value because it comes from a later pipeline stage. And it's going to be written later on. It's based on stuff that was read earlier. So this makes sense. Any questions? So for our other mucks, we'd have a similar concept, but we'd be comparing reg source B and reg output B and dval B. That's all the same things except for the B signal instead of the A signal, but we'd still be comparing to this E signal here, because that's the pair thing we have to forward from. It's the same place. So the general pattern is you compare register numbers, and you're always comparing the register number of the place you're forwarding to, like what that register that comes from, to the register number that the thing you're forwarding from will go to eventually. And generally, you should think about all your values later in the pipeline. There's some corresponding value, which is that register number. So if you remember when I talked about organizing our five-stage pipeline, I mentioned that we would move the calculation of destination registers to the decode stage. This is the primary reason why. That it sure is very convenient that we have this dest D wire and not a RA RB wire, and we need to figure out, like, is this an instruction that writes to RB or RA? That we really want to have these destination wires so we know how to interpret values later on, and then say, what register will this go to? So that's why we wanted to compute that in the decode stage, and that's what I would strongly recommend. You can make a correct processor where you just like pass RA through, but then if you have a processor which does more than adds, so this only does adds, so it's not a problem. If you have a processor which does more than adds, you need to say like, oh, this is a pop, so what's the register it writes to? Oh, that's RSP, and you need to have that special case every time you check this, rather than just comparing with dest D and knowing, oh, pop writes val E to RSP. So this is why we're gonna compute in our decode stage and get this dest E value, and similarly for dest M. That's what the textbook does. That's what I strongly recommend because it makes this logic easier to write. You don't have to figure out different cases for different instructions depending on how they write to registers. You just handle all those in the decode stage, compute where it's going to go. So any questions about our forwarding sort of diagram here? Okay. So I've shown you a simple sort of case of forwarding, because this is our add queue processor. We only do adds. We are missing in the memory stage entirely. And I also haven't included all the cases. So generally, I'm going to show like what forwarding happens by writing out a diagram like this. So I'm showing across the top, going horizontally, time. And I'm showing what stage each instruction is in. And the general rule is that if we don't do anything, the instruction will write its value at the end of the writeback stage and make it available for the next instruction, which runs a decode stage. Which means that whenever this addQ instruction writes to R9, this XOR Q instruction can read from R9 without doing anything special. We don't need forwarding. It can just use the register file because we're going to write to R9 here. We're going to read from it here. Everything's good. We actually get the up-to-date value. We don't have an out-of-date version. Otherwise, you can generally draw a line to where we're going to read the value, which is the decode stage, and you need that to not go backwards in time. And this is how we can figure out where we forward. So, for example, this add instruction writes to R9, then the sub instruction reads from R9. So at the end of the decode stage, we need to have a copy of R9. So we're going to forward to the end of the decode stage. And we can't forward backwards in time. We can't forward across stages. It's going to be from one stage to the other. So we're going to forward a value that's sitting around in the execute stage to the decode stage of the subtract instruction. And this is the case we just saw. It's that way of forwarding. But there's other ways we might have to forward. So for example, and this is probably the most subtle one, this rmoveq instruction takes the value that addQ wrote out and writes it out. It would read it here, which is too early to get the up version that addQ would have written. If we do nothing, then we're going to get an old version that's before the addQ instruction. So we're going to need to forward it. So we're going to have another forwarding path, which just means that we're going to do the equivalent of adding here. We're going to add another input to that mux and more control and another condition in our mux conditions. And we can just go through and see where our values are used. So I've gone through all the cases where R9 is used. I've determined that the case where it's used by XORQ is not a problem. We don't need to do anything. But for rmoveq, we do need to have a forwarding. We need to use one of these muxes to shortcut a value because the register file is going to be just a little bit too slow. So then we have our subq writes to R11, and this mrmoveq reads from R11 to compute an address. So that's another case where we're going to replace the value we read from decode with this value from execute, which is the forwarding path we saw before. It just happens that we're going to an instruction that has a slightly different syntax and assembly. And we also end up needing to send this R11 that rmoveq reads in order to compute its address from the memory stage of the subtract instruction. So even though the subtract instruction doesn't use the memory stage, it still has the value that it computed in the execute stage sitting around on some wire. And we're going to take that wire and we're going to send it as an input to the mux for this rmoveq instruction to work correctly. And we have a similar case like that between mrmoveq and xorq. So for mrmoveq, we get the value of that's going to be written to R10, which is only available after it's read from memory. Fortunately, that's exactly when we need it. So we're going to take that value from the data memory, and we're going to shortcut it to replace the value we would have read from the register file that's going to be out of date, because we want the value that was just read from memory. That's going to be written a cycle later. Yes?
How do we ensure that, like, we're not giving it too early of a check? Like, let's just say that rmoveq before the instruction went to, like, R9, 8, 10. How do we know which parts that we need?
So the question is, how do we know? So if rmoveq, so what's your hypothetical?
Rmoveq.
rmoveq is R8.
Yeah.
the RMOQ doesn't write to any of these registers. If the MRMOQ, you're asking like maybe if it goes to R11, how do we know which one to give to RMOQ? Okay, well, hopefully, I'll get back to you later if we don't cover this. We're gonna cover several cases where this isn't so straightforward. So here, so the general pattern is you look where, you read a value that you just wrote, and you just need to send it from wherever it happens to be to the end of the decode stage to replace the value we would have read from the register file. So there are some cases where we need to be a little careful. So one of them is here. You might be say, oh, this instruction writes R8, so I'm going to send its R8 to this last instruction, which reads R8. And that is not going to work. What's the problem? Sorry? Yeah, so the second instruction also changes R8. And which version do we want? We want the version that's going to be written just before. Whatever is going to be in the register file, we want the most recent version, which comes from the instruction which is furthest along the pipeline. So we don't want this version, which is least far along the pipeline. So we don't want this version from memory, we want the version from execute, because that instruction was started more recently. So yes, we could forward from memory, but we're going to actually forward from execute, because that's going to give us the right answer. And forwarding from memory is going to give us a different wrong answer. So this means that in HCL, we're going to have to be careful. So if you remember when we talked about our case expressions, I said that they were evaluated in order. And you like had a quiz question on this. And this is partly to make implementing things like forwarding simpler. That we're going to need to have the correct priorities here, that if there's a match between what's in execute, we want to take the value from execute. If there's a match between what's in memory, we want to take the value from memory. But if there's both, we want to do the one I've listed first here, which is the execute one. And the purpose of the case expressions being evaluated in order is to make this easy. You just make sure you list them in the right order, so the one you want to happen, if all multiple of them are true, is first. And in this case, we want to go from execute, not from memory. And similarly, if we had a write back up here, we'd want to not go from write back if we could go from memory or execute, because we want the most recent version of the value, which is going to be closest to the beginning of the pipeline. Yes?
Would you also need to forward between the first and second add queue?
Question is, would you need to forward between the first and second add queue? Yes. Yes, we would exactly also have this forwarding path. This forwarding path here.
And on the previous slide, why is it sometimes you get the document executed, other times you get it from memory?
So if this instruction, if the second instruction here wrote to, R10, then we want to get the value from memory. For the last instruction, we want to use the red dotted line.
What makes you pick execute on memory?
So the rule is that when we're choosing a value, we're always choosing it because we reading a register that's equal to be written register with the value in that stage. So we have a to-be-written value in the execute stage, and we're reading it, we want to forward that. If we have a to-be-written value in the memory stage, which we're reading, we also want to forward that. But the rule is that if we have both, that this scenario shows us, if we have both, we want to take the execute one, not the memory one, which would be way older. We want the most up-to-date one. But if we only have one, we're going to take the memory one. If we only have memory, we're going to take memory. We don't want to take nothing, because that's going to be another wrong value. So So another notable thing is that we can have an instruction where we forward two values. In this case, we forward R8 to replace register B that's read, and we forward R12 to replace register A that's read. And that's not, in fact, going to be a pretty common case that we have those two muxes. Both of them end up being used, not with the same value, which means that you need to have the cases for both of them. So that will happen. Okay. So any questions on either of these cases? This is the answer you were looking at. Okay. So something this brings up is that we have sometimes talks about hazards and dependencies, and these are different things. So a dependency is that two instructions are related to each other, that the result of one instruction is used by another. Hazards are dependencies which cause problems in a particular pipeline, where basically the idea is before we do things like forwarding or stalling, the pipeline is wrong because of the dependency. And we're going to distinguish between these. And probably the biggest distinction is that hazards, you need to know what the pipeline looks like. In our single cycle processor, there are no hazards. We don't have to worry about dependencies because we do instructions one at a time. It's only when we have instructions, multiple instructions at once, that we have to start worrying about hazards. But dependencies still exist with our single cycle processor because this definition doesn't specify how the instructions are executed. It's just a property of the instructions themselves. The hazards are a property of the instructions on a particular processor. And the particular processor needed to do extra work to make them happen, which depends on how the processor is designed, like how many pipeline stages there are. So here I have some instructions. A list of instructions, and let's say these are in order in assembly. So where are their dependencies? Which of these are hazards in the pipeline that we've been talking about? Fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. And which can we resolve with forwarding? And for each one we can resolve with forwarding, it would be good to figure out what stages do you need to forward. That's going to tell you if forwarding is possible. I'll give you a few minutes. I would write things down, but maybe you aren't.
Yeah.
Someone want to volunteer to tell me what where the dependencies are? Okay, so this is a dependency. So the second add queue, the last add queue needs the value that the previous add queue just wrote. You have more? We'll get to the forwarding later. We'll do that all together. I just want all the dependencies. Yeah.
RCX.
From
iRemove queue to add queue.
Okay. So this add queue needs the value that iRemove queue just wrote. Any more dependencies? Yeah.
RBX, the first add queue, the last add queue.
Yeah. So this RBX value is the same one that this add queue, the first add queue writes, is the same one the last add queue reads. Any more dependencies? Yeah. RCX from, okay, so you want to have this dependency. This is the tricky one. So yes, you're like, oh, iRemove queues RCX, subqueues writes RCX. It's not a dependency because iRemove queue doesn't care what the previous value of RCX was. So it doesn't change how that instruction runs. The subqueue result just changes some condition codes and then gets ignored. So that's not a dependency. That is the tricky case on here. So how about which of these are hazards? Yeah.
The RCX,
you have to iRemove queue. Okay, so this RCX is a hazard, and why is that a hazard? Yeah, so it will write naturally over here. It wants to read here. That goes back in time. That's a problem. Any other hazards? Yeah. You keep going.
Okay.
R10. An R10. Okay. And it's going to be a similar reason that we're going to write here. We want to read here. That goes back in time. Okay. Do you think? There, and for our last case, we want to write at the end of the write-back stage, we want to read during this decode stage. We see that if we draw an arrow, that goes forward in time, so there's no problem, we don't need to do anything. Okay, so how about figuring out whether these two cases where we have a hazard can be solved with forwarding? So how do we do that? Someone want to explain how I can figure out if we can solve it with forwarding? I was hoping for someone had it gone, but okay.
For R10, we want to be
executing
the decode.
Okay, so here we say, okay, so we want it here at the end of decode, and the question is, where is the value? And we're going to say, oh, we just computed an execute, so that's fine. And we're going to use the same logic for our other hazard, which is that, okay, so we want RCX here at the end, in the, near the end of the code. And the question is that value available from the execute stage of IRemoveQ? Well, we say, where did the value come from? Where did we have it? We first got it in the fetch stage, so we can definitely have it in the execute stage. We just need to have it pass through the pipeline, which it better be because we're writing it back. So, in fact, we can do that with forwarding. Okay, so any questions on this example? Yeah?
Is there any point to having the sub-queue and the IRemoveQ? The IRemoveQ is replacing RCVX, would the compiler ever generate that code?
So the question is, would the compiler ever generate this code? Hopefully not. If we had instructions where we didn't change the condition codes, then after the IRemoveQ, then the sub-queue would do something, however. Okay, so how about this example? And assume that these instructions, that the jump ends up being taken. Someone want to walk me through the dependencies here? Yeah. Okay. RBX from here to here? To the add, okay. So RCX from this add to the other add, okay. Any more? RDX, okay. From here to where? To the MRMove address. Any more dependencies? You can see. Or someone else? So you went to, you say RCX from the first add queue to the MRMove queue. So any dispute on that one? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so like the IRemoveQ, this is not a dependency because the MRemoveQ doesn't care what was in RCX. It's just going to replace it no matter what it was. So it's not a dependency. Anyone still see other dependencies? Okay, yeah, so the jump needs some information to decide whether or not it's taken. What information is that from? The condition codes, where are they going to be set? In the one before it. So this add instruction sets condition codes, so we have the condition codes are a dependency there. Because we need the add to finish to know what the condition codes are. Yes? Yes, so if you assume that the code is exactly as written, yes, it actually doesn't matter, yes. And this is, we'd be more careful if we asked this on an exam.
So if there are instructions like MRMoveQ and IRemoveQ, we're probably never going to have a dependency on like the write.
So if the instruction is overwriting a value and doesn't care what the previous value is, you can't have a dependency with that value. Yes. And IRemoveQ and MRemoveQ are two examples of that. Like popQ is another example. Okay, so which of these are hazards? Someone want to tell me? Yeah. The first one. So this is a, so this first one is a hazard because we have fetch, decode, execute, memory write back. It's going to be written here. We want to read it here. that's not written soon enough. Okay? And any of the others you want to volunteer or hazards? Yeah. Okay, the RCX from add queue. So this is a complicated one because it depends on how jump works. So we're going to skip over that for now. Because it depends how long does the jump take. If it happens immediately, yes, it's a hazard. If it doesn't, maybe not. Okay. Yeah.
The RDX.
The RDX. So this is a hazard. Okay. Because we have this value that we are computing here, and we want it at the end of the code here. So, but we don't write it till there, so that's back in time. So which of these can we resolve with forwarding? Well, so I'll just go through this to save time. So this hazard here, can we resolve it with forwarding, this first one? Someone want to tell me yes or no? Yes, so someone want to volunteer to explain? No? Okay. Yeah.
I think so, no.
No, why not?
Because we can get the memory value from the end station of the first one.
Yeah, so we would want to forward to here, and we want to forward from the end of X cube, but the value is read here. So this doesn't work. So there's no wire which contains the value in the execute stage. It's not computed yet. So this is no forwarding only. So this can't be resolved with just forwarding. The other case can be, because we have a value that's computed in the execute, we can forward that. Now that first one doesn't work with forwarding. Forwarding is not, we can't get the value soon enough. Yes?
For the first one, would you be able to stall for one cycle and then forward?
The question is, for the first one, will you stall for one cycle and then forward? Would that work? Yes. And that is, in fact, what we will have you do for this case when you implement a processor. Which I think I will go over sometime later, or we'll go over next time. So something to note about pipelines and hazards is that they're dependent on the pipeline. So if we have a different pipeline, you have different hazards. So, for example, with a 4-stage pipeline, this isn't a hazard. With a 5-stage pipeline, it is. With a 4-stage pipeline, the write-back happens soon enough that we're fine. With a 5-stage one, we're in the middle of the write-back stage while we're trying to read R8. So it doesn't work out. And generally, the way I figure this out, so here's an exercise, we have a different pipeline. What I would figure out is you make a table like this, you figure out where forwarding happens, and you can figure out, well, how much stalling do we need to do? So I'll give you a couple minutes, or a minute or so, to go through this. So I've split up the execute stage. So we're saying that for this add queue, the result is available here. That we have an ALU that takes 2 stages. We can't use any ALU results until execute 2. And I guess something I note is that to solve this, we're going to use stalling and forwarding, like was suggested for our load hazard, load to execute. We're going to use stalling and forwarding, so we're not going to stall until things get to write back. We're just going to stall long enough so that we can successfully forward, that we don't have that backwards in time problem where like we had a value in memory, which was, you know, that was computed in memory and that wasn't available and soon enough.
But you can get
Who needs more time? So I'll, for the interest of time, go through my answer. And the way I figured this out is I write out the stages and figure out where does information need to go. So if I do the straightforward thing, I'm saying, okay, I need R9 at the end of the decode stage. And the instruction that's computing it, it's in the execute one stage, so that's the line I want to draw. And I say, okay, can I actually get R9 from there? And the answer is no, because the rule is that we need it at the end of E2. But that's when it's computed, because this is an add. It's the result of the ALU, which is not going to be finished until the last execute stage in the specification I gave on the previous slide. And because of that, we move everything forward by one cycle. Then we say, can I forward now? And the answer is yes. Now that I've delayed everything by one cycle, now I'm looking for the value at the end of my decode stage. I'm getting it from the end of the execute2. It's available in time. That works. Yes? So I have decided to stall by stalling in the code. I could have written F here and crossed this out. They're the same. We saw the example, I think, last time with like stalling for add. We could stall in fetch or decode. I've just chosen to stall in decode. But the result's the same. It's just a matter of, you know, what's happening in the stalled stages. Okay. So then I look at my next dependency, which is this one. So here, I want to, at this point in time, I want to read R9. And I draw my line now, and that just works. We know R9 is computed in time for the memory stage because it was computed a cycle earlier. So you can just, we have that value somewhere, we can send it to our decode stage of this third add instruction. Yes?
Is it possible to forward from the second add queue instruction since we have R9 that we have forwarded from?
So the question is, could we forward from the second add queue instruction? Yes, we will not do that in our processor design, just to keep things simpler. But yes, it is on a wire there. You can figure out what register that belongs to and potentially get it, but we're not going to do that just to simplify our forwarding. Yes?
Could you also get it from the execute2 from the first add queue statement?
So the question is, could I do this path? And the answer is, no, because it has to go through a pipeline register, right? Because those are different times. So this is a, you know, needs pipeline register. And in fact, the pipeline register we're going to use is the one between execute2 and memory to exactly do that. Pipeline reg, different times. Because we have to go forward in time, we need a register to save it. And in fact, the register we're saving it in is the pipeline register that the first add queue instruction is using. So then we look at our next dependency, which is going to be this RBX to here. So we need this RBX to compute the address. And it's in fact available in time, so that just works. Then we have our last dependency with this is R9 to here. And this is a subtle thing. So our textbook, when it forwards, it always forwards, I'm going to draw in a different color. So here, for this, it always forwards to the end of decode. That's how our textbook does forwarding. But in real processors, if you have a complicated pipeline like this, we don't actually need the value of R9 until we input it into the memory. So we could forward it just before there, and that would work, because we still have a copy of it. And this would be something that a processor with this type of pipeline would probably do, because it saves a lot of stalling, right? Otherwise, we have to stall for two extra cycles, or not two, for one extra cycle in order to avoid the problem that we need to get the value that was just computed by the add into the R move queue. So in our textbook, would not do this. So not done by textbook, but done by real CPUs. So this means rather than replacing the value just after we read it, we replace it just after we read it, and sometimes also later on. This is trickier to deal with, which is why our textbook doesn't do it, because you have to make sure I'm forwarding the value at least once. And that's harder to figure out if there's multiple places you can send it to. Okay, so any questions on this? Yes. So what are we doing? So what is the rmove queue instructions general for? So it's rmove queue from, I think it's RB or RA, and then what? What's the second? D of RB. So here, D is implicitly 0, but it's still in the instruction, so we still need to do that add. Okay. Unless we have like some fast way of detecting we don't actually need to do it.
And so that add happens during the execute stage?
That add happens during the execute stage, even though, it's 0, adding 0, we still have the add happen, we still need to have RBX available for that add. Any other questions? Yeah.
Why do we need two F for the third add to?
Why do we need two F? As I said, this is because we're waiting behind the second add queue, which is being left in the code. Since this is being stuck into code, we can't go to the code while at the same time.
So we cannot fetch until it's.
We can't fetch this instruction. So we have to wait in line. If the instruction ahead of us isn't advancing in the pipeline, we can't advance either. So any other questions? Okay. So that dealt with data dependencies mostly. So we've made them a lot better. We still have some cases where we stall, and we have. We alluded to the one case, which we'll review later, that we stall on a real processor, which is loading a value from memory and then using it in the execute step. But we've dealt with most of them and made it so we don't stall for up to 3 cycles in data dependencies. We're just doing 1 sometimes. That's it, turns out. Then we still have conditional jump, and we want to do something better for this control hazard. And we're going to use a trick, which is going to be basically to guess and check. We're going to guess where the conditional jump's gonna go. And we're gonna check our result later on before we do anything too wrong. So we're gonna do some wrong stuff, and we're gonna figure out, maybe you shouldn't have done that, but we're gonna fix some mistakes before anything goes bad. And the reason we can get away with this is because instructions don't actually change much until later in the pipeline. So in the fetch stage, nothing changes based on what instruction you're running. In the decode stage, nothing changes based on what your instruction you're running. Yeah, we read stuff and forward stuff, but we don't actually change any stored values. So if we do the wrong thing in fetch and decode, no one cares. No one's going to know as long as we don't let those values sneak out into the execute stage. And even in the execute stage, if we do wrong stuff, as long as we don't change the condition codes, no one's going to know. So to undo an instruction during fetch and decode, we just forget everything we have in pipeline registers. That's the only thing we're actually changing. And we've undone the instruction. It's as if that wrong stuff never happened. And this is what we're going to use to make guesses. So we're going to make guesses. We're going to send them through the pipeline. And as long as they don't get too far, we just clear out the pipeline registers when we figure out that we guessed wrong. And it's going to be all OK. And if we wanted to figure out we guessed wrong later, as long as we can undo like the changes to the condition codes or the changes to memory or the changes to registers, we could do it later too. For our processor and our textbook, we're not going to do that. But real processors, in fact, do that. But the logic is obviously a bit more complicated because you need to figure out, oh, I changed memory, how do I undo that? So the way we're going to speculate that our textbook chooses, and this is an arbitrary choice, is that when we see a conditional jump of any kind, we guess that it's going to go to the label specified. So our guess is that if we see this conditional jump, that yes, we're going to label. And if we're right, we're going to be two cycles faster, that we're going to start executing the right instruction right away rather than waiting for the jump to figure out all the condition codes. And if we're wrong, we're going to have those two cycles where we do the wrong thing, and then we're going to forget about all that wrong stuff we did and move on and execute this XOR with a two-cycle delay, which is the same delay we had when we had to stall. So our grid path is that we execute the jump, we fetch the jump, we send it to the code, and while we have our jump in the decode stage, where it doesn't do very much, but it's waiting to get to the execute stage to use the condition codes, we fetch the add queue instruction that we guess it's going to jump to, and then we fetch the rmove queue instruction we guess it's going to jump to, decode the add queue instruction, and figure out, oh, the jump was right. We're good. And if the jump's right, we do nothing. That we have these two extra instructions where we previously had to wait. And after that, we just keep on going as if everything's fine. We just go on to rmoveq, the instruction after rmoveq, like everything was good, and there's no extra work to do. So this guess and check method, when we guess right, is in fact simpler than stalling. We do less work. That when we're stalled, we have to figure out whether we were right anyways, and we also have to stall. Now we don't even have to stall. We just go ahead. The case where it's not simpler is if we guess wrong. So if we guess wrong, we're going to run our add queue and our and remove queue. And in execute, we're going to figure out, oh, OK, I'm figuring out this jump is taken. And we're going to have to say, oops, OK, that add queue in the code, let's not let it go to execute, because then it's going to change my condition codes, and I don't want that to happen. And the rmove queue, let's not let it go through the pipeline, because then we'll eventually write to memory, and we don't want that to happen. So we take the values that would be going to those pipeline registers, and we have mux, we replace them with a NOAA. And this is known as squashing. This is a vocab term for this, not just a funny analogy. So we squash these wrong guesses when we figure out that, oh, we guessed wrong. And in addition to squashing the wrong guesses, we need to figure out what the next instruction to fetch is. So we send the address that we should have fetched, which is the address after the jump of the XOR in this case, and send that to the fetch stage to replace what we would have fetched, which is the IRMOVE queue we saw previously after the RMOVE queue. So rather than using, you know, the guesses next instruction, we use something we remembered when we started the jump as the place to go. Okay. So any questions about this procedure? So this whole process is known as branch prediction. And it's going to make things a bunch faster. So how much faster depends on, well, what instructions we're running. Because it depends on how often our guesses are right. But our guesses don't need to be right that often in order for branch prediction to be pretty good. So here I'm saying that 5% of the time we execute a taken conditional jump, 3% of the time we execute a not taken conditional jump. So our guess is right a little more than half the time for the 8% of the instructions that are conditional jumps. And if we compute given how many cycles we take to execute these instructions, we see that this is, you know, given us an extra 10% basically in our performance. And this is even though we're right basically like a little over 60% of the time. Okay, so any questions? This calculation? Yeah.
Just really quickly, like, as like a comparison, if you were to create an assembly program that had like three or four jumps instead of one jump that, like, if you had an assembly program with one jump that worked like half the time, and then you had like, but you could translate it to another portion that had like three jumps, but they worked like 80%, which one would be faster?
So the question is, like, just knowing that this happens, like, can I write faster assembly code? And like, what cases will be faster? Like, is more jumps that are usually taken faster? And on a real processor, the answer is really complicated. So I've given you a very simple guess, which is we guess the jump is taken. On real processors, they have very complicated guesses. I think I have a picture for this. So this blue region, so this is a die photo from 2004. So this is a picture of a processor. Most of the processor is cache. That's the yellow and orange stuff is cache. The blue region of the processor is branch prediction logic. That's how this the processor has that much space dedicated to making guesses about which ways jumps will go. The red region is the registers. Okay, it uses more space for that than it does for both integer and floating point registers. So it's all very complicated, which means that answering that question is not at all straightforward. You basically have to test things. Like, it can matter, it does matter, but how it matters is not so straightforward because the prediction is not just always taken, which is what we're gonna do for our processor because that's easy to implement. But that's, you can in fact do a lot better than that, but you need a lot more logic. Okay, so let's talk about making this happen with our PC. So we had a bunch of things we need to do to change our PC. So one thing is we needed stalls. Another thing is we needed to deal with these jumps where we figure out later on whether or not the jump is taken. So we're gonna have a bunch of extra cases, and the basic idea is that sometimes our new PC, rather than being the instruction, next instruction in the program, is the same value. This is when we're stalling. So like we're waiting for something to happen, we know we have a return. Sometimes it's that next value. Sometimes it's the location we're jumping to. When we have a conditional or unconditional jump, it's that location we write from the instruction. We saw that case in the single cycle processor. Sometimes, when we guess the jump wrong, we need to send back the address that we should have gone to, the value that was here from the jump, to fix our wrong guess. And we're gonna have a whole bunch of control logic that needs to know not only like, is it a jump or not, but do we need to stall? Needs to figure that out. Is the jump taken or not, so I know whether I need to use the correction I have. Is this a return, which is about to finish, and so on. So something I note that is a bit confusing is that our book doesn't organize things this way. So our book just takes this mux here and moves it after the program count, which is exactly equivalent. They've just decided that rather than the program counter containing the address we'll fetch next, it contains our initial guess of that, and we fix it up later, rather than fixing it up before we put it in the PC. So they call this a predicted PC. So that's replacing our PC, and it's just that we're taking, rather than the value after this mux, we're taking the value that would go on this wire and moving that mux just after the register. But it's the same result, it's just a different way of organizing things, which happens to be arguably more convenient for dealing with our branch prediction and our returns, where we have to deal with stalling and so on. Okay, so I think that's all I have time for today. So next time we'll talk about, well, we talked about stalling and squashing. How does that actually turn into HCL? and we'll look at that problem.